Today, the debt trap springs. The DFA Daily to the 9th of April 2020. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics World's latest post covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. I, of course, have been calling out the problem with high debt levels for many years. But now, unfortunately, the truth is being exposed. So, for example, Bloomberg today highlighted that Australia's enviable record of almost 30 years without a recession comes with a less desirable record of highly indebted households and sky-high property prices. This raises the risk that the recovery could take longer and could increase financial stability concerns if people can't cover their loans. Household debt is almost double disposable income, twice the level of the US, and well over a year's annual output. Mainstream economists and the central bank have long argued that while people have jobs and can service those loans, the risk of a hard landing is slim. But Centrelink, which manages welfare payments for the unemployed, has seen queues snaking down streets in recent weeks as tens of thousands of people seek support, with others heading out to the bush in the hope of finding work on farms. It's reminiscent of the 1930s, but it's 2020 and a phenomenon being replicated worldwide. Some estimate that an additional 700,000 people are already out of work, and more will follow. Australia's central bank governor is warning of a very large economic contraction and unemployment increasing to its highest level for many years. And that's an unusually blunt assessment from the typically optimistic Phil Lowe. There's no doubt that we're going into the greatest job destruction period ever, said Bob Gregory, a professor at Australian National University in Canberra who specialises in the labour market and who has studied the economy for more than half a century. This looks like the most serious recession depression that we've had since the 1930s, and there's going to be a big income loss in the next 6 months. This is why Australia, together with other high household debt economies like Denmark, the UK and Canada, are offering subsidies to ensure workers have an income and to keep them connected to firms. Banks down under are offering repayment holidays to help tide homeowners over. And the government last week pledged $130 billion to a rescue plan that will subsidise workers' pay to about 70% of the median wage. And while this is positive and important for firms and workers, at about $1,500 a fortnight, it isn't going to go a long way in major centres like Sydney and Melbourne. The unemployment outlook is a centre of conjecture. And indeed, Roy Morgan's data today showed a significant rise to 17%. The government's aim is to keep employees tied to their firms even if they're not working, and it will help to suppress the official unemployment number. Still, a number of economists are predicting the rate will surge beyond 10%. And more worryingly, few expect a rapid rebound. Those mostly directly impacted by the lack of tourists, empty beaches and no activity on the streets are waiters, bar staff, baristas and so forth. And while many in such professions are young, and probably analysis from the RBA found around two-thirds of homeowner debt is held by the top 40% of income earners, yet if the downturn is prolonged and there is a broadening of job losses across other sectors, this would have larger impacts on the housing market. Australia's high household debt was never going to be a cause of a recession, but it would quite possibly magnify the impact of anything else that caused a recession, said Saul Eslake, an independent economist who has analysed the Australian economy for 40 years. The risk isn't so much to the financial system that there will be a wave of defaults, he said, but rather the risk was to the economy arising from what highly indebted households would do to avoid defaulting, which is substantially cut back their spending. Australians were in fact already consuming less as the debt climbed. And while Australia's banks are allowing some to defer repayments, most aren't actually foregoing interest during the period, so it will be added to a borrower's outstanding principal, which will then require either higher repayments or a longer repayment term by the mortgagee. The RBA, in its semi-annual financial stability review, which was released today, referenced high household debt as a long-standing risk and acknowledged that many households will find their finances under strain during the efforts to contain the health issue. Yet it said tighter lending standards in recent years had improved the quality of debt. The review cited data showing most households have enough liquid assets, that's cash, equity investments, mortgage repayments, etc., to cover living expenses for 3 months. But there are some pockets of vulnerability, it said, with the same data indicating that about 1 in 5 households only had enough liquid assets to get from one pay period to the next. For those with mortgages, just under 1/3 of mortgages have less than 1 month of prepayments, and about half of these appear particularly vulnerable to a sharp decline in income, the bank said. The threat of unemployment to people's ability to meet their debts is key. RBA's analysis of loan-level data and historical relationships show that for every 1 percentage point increase in unemployment, mortgage arrears increase by about 0.8 percentage points. The expected rise in unemployment will lower households' abilities to service their debts, but government transfers to directly affected households and wage subsidies for affected employees will mitigate this to some extent, it said. And the nation's prudential regulator recently conducted a stress test on banks based on a scenario of unemployment reaching 11%. Under this, lenders incurred significant losses and a substantial reduction in capital, but the latter was sufficient to remain above the regulatory minimum. On top of that, last year's Royal Commission into Misconduct in the Banking System actually didn't uncover widespread lax lending, easing concerns that Australia would be at the risk of a US-style subprime crisis. Indeed, 2/3 of Australian mortgagees are also ahead on repayments, as many people kept handing over the same amount, even as interest rates fell sharply in recent years. Yet Gregory and Eslake see little chance of a V-shaped recovery. Both expect higher unemployment to persist, and key industries like international tourism, education, which accounts for about 5% of GDP, taking time to return to previous levels, if they ever do. And the RBA's financial stability review made for even more painful reading. For example, they said that over-the-counter withdrawals of cash from banks were elevated over the second half of March as some customers with large balances sought to hold precautionary funds. This included a small number of customers making very large withdrawals, more than $100,000, and in some cases into the millions of dollars. The Reserve Bank worked closely with the large banks and cash-in-transit companies to ensure branches had enough cash supplies. The focus of this work was on the logistics of moving cash to the right places, as there was adequate total supply. And they said the elevated demand has since abated. And this explains some of the reports that we had of people finding it difficult to get money out of the bank and severe limits being imposed. It was more about moving the cash around than the cash not being available at all. And another topic that the Reserve Bank touched on was Australian bank bonds. They said around $30 billion of Australian bank bonds will mature during the June quarter, with a further $50 billion maturing over the second half of 2020. This equates to less than 3% of system-wide funding. The Reserve Bank will provide banks with enough low-cost funding to replace almost all of the maturing bond funding over the next 6 months if bond markets remain dysfunctional. Banks' funding allowances under this facility equates to around $90 billion, or 3% of total credit. The facility also enables banks to access additional funding beyond this if they expand business lending through either drawdowns on existing committed credit facilities or new commitments. For credit extended to small and medium enterprises, this additional allowance is 5 times the credit extended. If some banks experience higher than normal superannuation deposit outflows or drawdowns by households of their offset accounts or committed credit facilities, they have excess high-quality liquid assets available to manage their liquidity flows. So in summary, the RBA concluded that banks have sufficient capital to withstand a prolonged period of stress, and the outlook for credit quality will weaken, but from a strong position. And other parts of the financial system have been resilient to the health issue so far. And then they went on to look at fund managers, which is something we've been highlighting recently as a risk area. They say fund managers have faced reduced liquidity for some assets at the same time as many have had greater need for liquidity. The decline in liquidity for some assets held by fund managers has been most notable for fixed income, including even sovereign debt. Some other assets they hold are never liquid, such as property infrastructure. This has made it difficult for managed funds that invest in loans and bonds, sometimes called credit funds, to rebalance and liquefy their assets. At the same time, fund managers have needed additional cash for a range of reasons. Redemption requests by investors in open-ended managed funds have been elevated as investors sought additional safety and liquidity of cash. Several credit funds have responded to this situation by increasing the cost of redeeming. This, along with drawdowns on funds' cash reserves and sales of short-term debt, has so far enabled them to meet cash demands without having to suspend redemptions as permitted under legislation. And superannuation funds have similarly required additional liquidity to cover higher member requests to switch from high to low risk investment options, in addition to needing to pay variation margin on the derivatives they use to hedge foreign currency assets. Superannuation funds hold liquidity buffers that have enabled them to manage these liquidity demands and have been redeeming term deposits to increase their liquidity. Some trustees have also lowered the value of their unlisted assets to ensure that investors reducing their exposures now are not overcompensated at the expense of remaining members. However, superannuation funds have also to prepare for members using the changed early release option, which was included in the government's stimulus package. For some funds in particular, those with many young members working in the industries heavily affected by the health issues, this will represent a relatively large share of funds under management and therefore a large liquidity drain. A substantial rise in the cost of issuing asset-backed securities has also limited the ability of non-ADI lenders to raise new funds. Some planned issues were subsequently deferred. Non-bank lenders have been able to do this because their warehouse funding facilities have been ample, having increased over recent years. However, the initial transactions from the Australian government's $15 billion fund for investing in asset-backed securities and warehouse facilities has already resulted in a significant easing in funding conditions for these lenders. There are some risks from property markets because a key financial stability risk is the extent to which the weakness in the economy spills over to the housing and commercial property markets. The prospect of large declines in property prices presents significant balance sheet risks for households, businesses and lenders. The shock to the economic activity and associated uncertainty has caused a decline in demand in residential property markets, and this will increase the incidence of negative equity if prices decline. The containment measures, including government restrictions on auctions and open inspections, will lower housing turnover. In turn, the significant reduction in housing turnover will make it difficult to accurately assess changes in housing prices at the period ahead. Auction volumes and clearance rates have declined sharply in Sydney and Melbourne in recent weeks. Consistent with this, liaison with banks suggests housing loan applications are falling, and information from housing contacts in the bank's liaison program also report much lower foot traffic through display homes. For households behind on their repayments and with little equity in their homes, very low turnover and declines in housing prices will make it harder to resolve the situation by selling their properties. Scenario-based analysis on loan-level data and historical relationships suggest that the decline in housing prices of 10% would raise the share of loans in negative equity by 3.5 percentage points to 6.5%. This is shown by an increase in the share of loans with a loan-to-value ratio above 100%. The share of loans in negative equity would increase by proportionally more for larger price declines. A higher incidence of negative equity increases the risk of loss ultimately incurred by lenders in the event of foreclosure. and conditions in the commercial property market are deteriorating. They were actually deteriorating prior to the health issue. The retail commercial property market was facing challenging conditions due to weaker consumer spending and heightened competition. The outlook for tenant demand for retail property has deteriorated given the downturn in trading conditions, with declines in rents and increases in vacancy rates now likely. Conditions in office markets were previously strong, but they are also expected to deteriorate in the period ahead. Of note, an above average volume of office supply is due to be delivered into the Sydney and Melbourne CBD markets this year, and demand will be unlikely to keep pace with this stronger supply. Overall, they say banks' commercial property exposures as a share of total bank assets around 6%, and non-bank lenders are particularly active in lending for the construction of commercial property, including apartments. So there you have it. The RBA is saying that there are a lot of stresses and strains in the system, and that individual businesses and households may get crunched, but at the moment the banks seem to be relatively secure and safe. And separately, ASIC has confirmed that responsible lending obligations are not a barrier to making variations from a principal interest loan to an interest-only loan term on a mortgage if consumers want to reduce their repayments in the short term. Following increasing calls for lenders to convert principal interest loans for investors into interest-only home loans so that repayments can be reduced during the current crisis, to act as a form of monetary stimulus, the corporate regulator has now confirmed that lenders would not be breaching the rules, the lending rules that is, should they agree to do so. ASIC has now written to lenders to confirm that responsible lending obligations are not a barrier to making variations from P&I to interest-only terms when this kind of change is sought by the consumer to reduce their repayments in the short term. A change of a loan from P&I to interest-only can be made by varying the terms of the existing contract as long as they are agreed between both the lender and the borrower. ASIC reiterated that variations to contracts do not trigger responsible lending obligations, as these obligations only apply before a loan is entered into or a credit limit is increased. However, ASIC has emphasised that it does not have a position on whether loans should be changed from P&I to interest only, given that this is a business decision and up to lenders to negotiate direct with customers who may be facing financial difficulty, and that consumers should ensure they understand the assistance they're getting and what is required of them after the assistance ends. Well, the point about that, of course, is that ultimately you still have to repay that loan. And given the amount of debt in the system, I am personally very concerned about this drive to switch people back to interest-only loans. Remember that there's been quite a focus from regulators up until recently to move people the other way, and now people are calling for this to be turned on its head. I'm afraid that I do not support this particular move, and I think it creates ever more risk and much higher debt ahead. And more broadly, the World Trade Organization has warned that the world trade is expected to fall between 13 and 32% in 2020 as a result of the health issue. Normal economic activity and life around the world has been cramped by the health issue, and the impact on international trade is not that visible yet. But some timely and leading indicators may already yield clues about the extent of the slowdown and how it compares to earlier crises. Indices of new export orders derived from purchasing manager indices, or PMIs, are particularly useful in this regard. The JP Morgan Global PMI for March showed export orders in manufacturing sinking to 43.2 relative to a baseline of 50, and new services exports dropping to 35.5, suggesting a severe downturn. And so they've come up with two distinct scenarios. Firstly, a relatively optimistic scenario with a sharp drop in trade followed by a recovery starting the second half of 2020. And two, a more pessimistic scenario with a steeper initial decline and a more prolonged and incomplete recovery. These should be viewed as explorations of different trajectories for the crisis, rather than specific predictions of future outcomes. Under the optimistic scenario, the recovery will be strong enough to bring trade close to its pre-pandemic levels, represented by the yellow line, while the pessimistic scenario only envisages a partial recovery. After the global financial crisis of 2008-09, trade never returned to its previous trend, represented by the dotted grey line on the same chart. A strong rebound is more likely if businesses and consumers view the health issue as a temporary one-time shock. In this case, spending on investment goods and consumer durables could resume at close to previous levels once the crisis abates. On the other hand, if the outbreak is prolonged and or recurring uncertainty becomes pervasive, households and businesses will likely be spending more cautiously under both scenarios, and all regions will suffer double-digit declines of exports and imports in 2020. If the health issue is brought under control and trade starts to expand again, most regions will record double-digit rebounds in 2021 of around 21% in the optimistic scenario and 24% in the pessimistic scenario, albeit from a much lower base. The extent of the uncertainty is very high and is well within the realm of possibilities that for both 2020 and 2021, the outcomes could be above or below those outcomes. And that really is the point, because nobody really knows how long this is going to go on for. But if I come back to my opening statement about debt, it seems to me that Australia is specifically exposed to the high levels of debt, particularly household debt and corporate debt. And the fact of the matter is, with the degrees of uncertainty that we're seeing at the moment, both in the economy and beyond, it seems to me that debt will become the touchstone, because the trouble is that we have very little wriggle room, and whilst there are some households and businesses that will have some buffers in the short term, because the longer this goes on, the more the risk of default and decline occurs. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.